Good morning, Janet Bailiff.
Good morning.
So you're a debt collector in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yes.
How long have you been doing that?
About 8 years now.
And that sounds like a tough job, calling somewhere around 150 people a day who don't necessarily want to be reminded about their debt.
Of course. You know, not a whole lot of people like to hear from us, mainly because of, you know, debt collectors' reputations.
So you've actually gotten a few debt collector calls yourself.
Yes. I actually have, unfortunately. So I know how it feels to be on the other side of the line.
So what's it like trying to collect from people in this tough economic environment?
It can be a little tough at times just because, I mean, obviously, we're all going through the same thing.
Making good during hard times, debt collectors, people who don't have to worry about their jobs. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's Monday, November 17th. Good morning, Catherine Lanfer. You're in for John Hockenberry today. Welcome back.
Indeed, I am, Adora, and it's nice to be here. In this hour, we look into the latest efforts to halt the import of tainted milk products from China. Also, questions from the National Black Chamber of Commerce about who is left out of the $700 billion economic bailout, as well as the first conversation in our new series on debt. Plus, what did yesterday's tsunami warning in Indonesia tell us about what we've learned since the 2004 tragedy? Those stories and more, but first, the news.
The lame duck Congress gets underway today, and the Senate is preparing for a collision over whether or not to spend $25 billion on the three big automakers. The White House and Republican leaders oppose a bailout. Republican Senator Richard Shelby said on Meet the Press yesterday that Detroit's failed to innovate.
They've got good workers, but I don't believe they've got good management. They don't innovate. They're a dinosaur in a sense, and I hate to see this.
Senate Democrats are driving ahead. They say they'll attach an auto bailout to a House-approved bill extending unemployment benefits. A vote could come as early as Wednesday.
President-elect Barack Obama will meet with John McCain in Chicago today, the first time the two have met since the election. McCain officials say they don't expect a job offer for McCain. So while the furious speculation is over who will be in Obama's cabinet, the president-elect told 60 Minutes last night that he is focused on keeping an eye on bigger enemies.
I think it's important to get a national security team in place because transition periods are potentially times of vulnerability to terrorist attack. We want to make sure that there is as seamless a transition on national security as possible.
While Obama's looking ahead to working with Congress, the current lame duck Congress is getting down to business today.
Three major wildfires are still burning around Southern California, and we're going to hear more about that later this hour. Meanwhile, oil is below $56 a barrel. European markets are down around 2%. Dow futures are also down.
We're doing a series on debt in America on The Takeaway. We're calling it Debtor Nation, and we want to hear how debt is affecting you, how you got into debt, and how you're getting out. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This week we're taking a hard look at debt. We're calling the special series Debtor Nation.
Hi, this is Jada Golden from Boston, Massachusetts, and my debt is stopping me from doing everything.
We want to hear your story. How much are you in debt? How'd you get there? And how you plan on getting out? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. With just 6 weeks to go until the UN mandate authorizing U.S. troops to operate in Iraq expires, Iraq's cabinet has approved a new security pact that sets out a phased withdrawal of U.S. troops through 2011, among other things. Joining us to talk more about this is New York Times correspondent Stephen Farrell and BBC correspondent Andrew North, both of them coming from Baghdad. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Stephen, let's start with you. What have the two sides agreed to?
Well, the two sides have agreed that American troops will leave Iraq in 2011 and they'll be out of major Iraqi cities in 2009. And they've agreed on what they can do while they remain, to put it simply, that they effectively need Iraqi permission to do a lot of things that they've been doing until now on their own authority. And that will start as of January the 1st. When the United Nations mandate, which governed the presence of American troops in Iraq, expires.
And, Andrew, these were tense negotiations that have gone on for nearly a year. What were the issues that finally allowed for this agreement that's moving forward?
Yeah, it's taken a lot of negotiation to get to this point. It's been a very sensitive issue here in Iraq because there are some political parties who even now see this as too much of a concession to the Americans. Some are saying that, in effect, it entrenches the U.S. occupation. But I think the key things that finally moved things on were compromises on the Iraqis gaining greater jurisdiction over American troops, the possibility that U.S. soldiers and contractors could be tried in an Iraqi court, although I think that's still very unlikely. And also a ban that has now been put in place on the Americans carrying out any raids on neighboring countries. You may remember just last month there was a U.S. Special Forces raid on neighboring Syria. That was another concern that they had.
In terms of the immunity, Andrew, this has been a very contentious issue, but it almost sounds a little vague when they're saying that U.S. soldiers are still guaranteed immunity except in cases of serious felonies committed while off duty outside their bases.
That's right. I mean, I think it is it's a compromise they've come up with where there will now be a joint committee that will decide in each case if the Iraqis want to try an American contractor or soldier for a violation committed outside a U.S. base, that they could possibly go before an Iraqi court. But clearly this is a red line issue. It long has been for the Americans all over the world. It's very unlikely that we'll see a soldier tried. But I think the interesting thing will be over contractors. You may remember what happened last year when the Blackwater Security Company, its operatives, shot dead 17 Iraqi civilians in central Baghdad. That caused massive outrage here, even more so when the Prime Minister, he initially tried to throw them out of the country, then discovered he didn't have the power. And I think the Iraqi government certainly in that case, they want to be seen to be gaining more control. And if it was a contractor that shot someone dead, then probably there would be, in future, much more pressure for them to go before an Iraqi court.
And in terms of control, Stephen, this phased out withdrawal certainly sends the message, or I would assume is intending to send the message, that U.S. troops are not going to stay in Iraq forever. Could you outline the phase out?
Yeah, I mean, this is really all about a nation's sense of itself and having control over its own destiny. And that's very much what an Iraqi government, which still operates under the umbrella of the American military, it wants to reestablish control over its own country. It's very, very keen, with elections coming up, that it isn't seen as a lackey of an occupying power, which is certainly how its opponents are going to paint it. So what they have said is, we want you out of the major cities by the middle of next year, and then we want you out of the country by the end of 2011, unless we decide. That's the key thing, that if we want you to stay on, if we decide security isn't good enough, then that's fine, that's our decision. But they were very, very keen on having this couched in terms of our decision and definitively, whereas the Americans are very keen, as this administration has been throughout, on having no set arbitrary deadlines, but having everything contingent on conditions on the ground. So there was an awful lot of talk about very detailed wording in pitching it between no conditions and conditional.
Stephen, this is Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry. What sense do you get that this agreement is going to pass in Iraq's parliament?
I think it's very likely. I think the sense we were getting from the American diplomats in the run-up was that Maliki, Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maliki, wasn't going to put it to parliament until he was sure that he would get it through because he didn't want to risk embarrassment. So he had a cabinet meeting before. 27 of 28 cabinet ministers who attended said yes, 9 weren't there. Assume they may be mixed, but it looks very likely that it will go through. This is not something, he doesn't have presidential powers. He's a prime minister. He's reliant on other parties. So he has to effectively do the electoral math. And it looks like with the support of the two biggest coalitions, that alone will give him enough. However, they need 138 votes. But what the nation's chief Shia cleric and what the government themselves have said is we don't want to do this on a majority plus one. We want to do this with consensus. That makes the bar considerably higher. And if the Sunnis kick up enough of a fuss and say you're railroading this through us, that isn't consensus and things could start to look a bit sticky.
And there's certainly been...
I think it's interesting, if I could just come in quickly. I think it's interesting because, in fact, there is... we have heard quite a lot of opposition to it, but to some extent, this opposition is a smokescreen. Now, when it comes from people like Muqtada Sadr, the anti-American cleric, he is very clearly set against the agreement. But in fact, many of the others who have spoken out against it, to some extent, are doing so because of local sensitivities. When you talk to them in private, they're in fact there's a lot more support for the agreement because it does, in fact, give the Iraqi government much more power over the Americans than they had before.
And when you bring in cleric al-Sadr, he called for protest demonstrations this coming Friday. What's your expectation as to how well that will be attended?
Well, that's going to be interesting because there have been many times before when he's called demonstrations and then at the last minute has called them off. But he's certainly been speaking out again a bit more loudly in the last few days. And this, in some ways, is a bit of a test of his credibility to show that he can bring people out onto the streets again. I mean, he's been very quiet really since the surge got underway and he called for a ceasefire for his men. But recently he's come out and said that he's forming a new unit to fight against the occupiers, as he puts it. So this Friday actually is going to be quite interesting to see what happens.
And Stephen, what do you think it means that the Grand Ayatollah, Ali al-Sistani, he's the most influential Shiite cleric, that he has essentially thrown his support behind this agreement?
It means everything. I spoke to a very senior Shia MP yesterday who said, look, very early on, Syed Sistani told us, these are the conditions I want met, these three conditions, and effectively don't come back to me until you've got these out of the Americans. And he said, on Saturday, we were able to go back to Sajistani and say we have these conditions, not quite 100% as we would want, but we've got them as good as we think we're going to get them, and he signed off on it. I think that Andrew's quite right. Sadr, it will be interesting to see on Friday, but Muqtada al-Sadr is far junior to Ayatollah Sistani in the Shia hierarchy. And I've been to many, many demonstrations in this country over the years. Sadr is getting fewer and fewer people to his demonstrations in recent months than he used to. And yet the one time I remember Ayatollah Sistani, back about 3 or 4 years ago, didn't like what the Americans were doing, clicked his fingers, and the next day there were hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets, and then he unclicked them and they disappeared. It was completely peaceful, but there's no question who delivers the country in terms of the Shia side of it anyway. It's Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani.
That's Stephen Farrell, New York Times Baghdad correspondent, and Andrew North, BBC correspondent in Baghdad. Thanks to both of you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
This week, The Takeaway is doing a series on debt in America. How's it affecting you?
The principal is never touched, no matter how much of payments I make. I'm a social worker, and I don't make a whole lot of money, and it seems like it's almost hopeless that this thing will ever get, you know, taken care of. Thank you very much for wanting to hear people's stories.
We do. We want to hear your story of getting into debt and getting out of debt. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Catherine Landfer is in for John Hockenberry today. Catherine?
That's right. I am, Adora. Now, you know, just last week, the Food and Drug Administration announced sweeping measures to make sure that Chinese food products made with tainted milk don't leave that country's borders. This week, two top U.S. health officials are going to China to take even more action, including the opening of three new FDA offices in China. Now, how is this move going to go over, and what exactly will it contribute to safety? We're going to find out as we talk to Benjamin England. He's a 17-year FDA veteran and a founder of the website FDAimports.com. All right, Benjamin, Chinese products that contain milk are going to be contained at the border until tests prove that they're not contaminated. This sounds great in theory, but what is it going to be like in practice?
Hi, good morning. I mean, in practice, the products actually will go to the importers. They won't even stay at the border. In the United States, the products will be distributed to the persons who own them, and they'll hold them. Part of the issue, I think, is that FDA's approach to this is going to end up grabbing a lot of products that either don't contain dairy ingredients or they're basically safe. Now, you know, many I think would say that that's fine because at least we're checking. But there's an awful lot of products that are going to be covered by this action that are going to have to go through testing that probably will result in an increase in food cost in food ultimately.
It sounds like you're talking about a big clog at all the ports.
I think the large concern. Right now we already have a problem with regard to Chinese food being held up for as much as 3 months waiting for FDA to release it. And the new action is going to be probably five to ten times as large. So it's going to increase a lot of expenses to the companies that import food from China.
All right. And who's going to bear the brunt of that cost?
I think up till now, the companies have been. But a lot of the same companies will be affected by the new action, and I don't think they can afford to. I think it'll get passed down.
Okay.
The consumer will pay for it.
Let's talk about these new FDA offices in China. What are they going to do?
Those are going to be manned mostly by folks, FDA folks who report to the Office of International Programs, International Affairs at FDA, who really are more of a political arm of the agency and not an inspection arm. Excuse me. So they're not going to be people on the ground who will be able to do inspections. They should be able to facilitate communication, but that's about it.
All right, and just help me understand this. You wag your finger and say, we're going to make sure that even more of your products don't make it in here until we thoroughly test them. And, oh, by the way, come by for the housewarming. How does that work?
Yeah, they're not going to be received, I think, very very warmly. There have been a lot of communication between FDA and HHS and the Chinese counterparts, mostly in the lead by HHS. I think one of the ironies, many of the folks I know at the FDA who've either participated or been very close to the meetings have said that in each and every meeting, the Chinese government response has been that we wouldn't really be having these problems if it wasn't for the American press. So there's a significant cultural divide that the government's position there seems to be that it's not the problems in the food. The problem is that the people know about the problems in the food. And so when FDA comes over or HHS comes over to the United States, they're already received rather coolly. Now, this is going to have such a huge effect on Chinese trade in foods that I think it's going to strain the relationship that much more.
But Benjamin, explain that further, will you? So Chinese officials don't believe that they have a production problem, that really it's the exposure of some of the issues that have come up is the problem?
I don't think that they don't believe that they have a problem. I just think that for them the value system just is different.
Benjamin, I got to stop you. A value system. People have died. Children have died.
That's right, and that's obviously the kind of thing that the Chinese are not going to want exposed to the world who they're trying to sell to, and you know the controls are that significant there.
Quickly, what if you're a consumer listening to this? Every time the tainted milk story comes up, I think it's just it's human to sort of react in fear. So, what's your advice?
There's very little fluid milk, very, very little fluid milk that comes out of China to the United States. I think the greater risk, I mean, people should be concerned. They should. The problem is there's nothing that they can do about it other than perhaps look at the country of origin labeling on their foods. But most foods are finished processed foods, and so that's not going to tell you anything because the dairy could come from anywhere, no matter where the food is finished.
Okay, Benjamin England, thank you, I think. Thank you so much. Benjamin England is a 17-year veteran of the FDA, and he's the founder of the website, FDAimports.com. We're going to turn now to Mark Garrison. He's sitting in today for Femi Okeh to give us the latest news.
Thank you, Catherine. Coming up on 28 minutes after the hour, the Japanese economy has fallen into a recession for the first time since 2001. It's the world's second largest economy, and it shrunk 0.4% in the third quarter. That follows a decline in the second quarter, and that's what economists can officially call a recession. Japan's main Nikkei index there edged up just slightly. Other Asian markets did not fare as well. Markets in Australia and India both down, and major indices in Europe are all down as well right now. The International Monetary Fund needs more money. The IMF chief says they'll need at least $100 billion in additional funding to help with the economic crisis. Pakistan is the latest country to get IMF help. A critical supply route between Pakistan and Afghanistan is open again. U.S. trucks began moving through the Khyber Pass today. There was heightened security after militants hijacked several trucks last week. Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants are active around the Afghan-Pakistan border. Future First Lady Michelle Obama joined her husband for the first post-election interview on 60 Minutes last night. She talked about parenting challenges after the kids stayed up late on election night.
It's like, okay, daddy's president-elect. Okay, we can get to school by 10. And we got to the school, and the folks at the school were excited. Some people were cheering as I walked the kids through the class. And I remember Malia saying, "That's embarrassing.
Mom, why did Dad have to get elected? Why are these people following us around like that?"
Yeah. It's a little tough for the kids, but they seem to be.
Are you imagining that, or
you know that is not a direct quote.
Okay,
I can't attribute that
sure.
to Malia or Sasha, but if I were in that situation, I was always like, "My parents are going to embarrass me," you know, in that age. So,
thanks, Mark.
Works presidentially as well.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Adora.
And we're talking about debt this morning, how people get in debt, how they get out, and the stories of the line in between.
I have another thought for you on saving. It's a riddle. When is it okay not to save? Answer, when you're pretty sure someone, for instance the government, is going to bail you out.
Oh, riddle me this.
We want to hear your stories. Please give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Subprime mortgages have been at the center, blamed for the financial crisis, blamed for everything from the international banking system's downfall to the exploitation of the poor. But Newsweek's senior editor, Dan Gross, has a different take. He's written an article this week that sheds a different perspective on things. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
So why shouldn't we be so quick to put all the blame on subprime mortgages?
Well, there's been this great tendency with all the debacles we've had to blame this whole mess on subprime lending. You know, lending to poor people, lending to working class people, lending to people who haven't been in the financial services mainstream. And what I set out to show in this article, that it's not the theory that was the problem, it was the practice. It was people lending recklessly to poor people, just in the same way that people who lend recklessly to really rich people, like these private equity firms and hedge funds and, oh, Donald Trump, they end up losing hundreds of millions of dollars, too. So we had this huge explosion in, you know, these companies that went out there, they had mortgage brokers, they made the loans, they sold them to Wall Street, they took their fees, they didn't care if the people could pay them back. They didn't care what they were doing to their customers. Those have all failed, and that business model is dead. But underneath this, on a much smaller scale, there's this group of, you know, what I call, or what people call, the ethical subprime lending industry. These are community development banks, community development credit unions. Some of them are nonprofits that are associated with churches or foundations. Others are for-profit. And what they do is they lend carefully to working class and poor people. They charge slightly higher rates than, prime people would get, but they don't lend people more than they can handle. They don't do all these funky, crazy loans, and they work with people to make sure that they get paid back.
And so you really want to distinguish between the two.
Exactly. And, you know, we've known for years with the microfinance trend, which is these groups in places like Bangladesh and Latin America that, you know, lend to really impoverished people at high rates of interest, and they have incredibly high rates of getting paid back. So it's not the notion that you can't lend to poor people. It's that you have to lend carefully and in a way that makes sense to them. So there's a group, the Lower East Side Credit Union, which is here in New York. They tell me their typical customer is a woman, usually from the Dominican Republic or from Puerto Rico, in her 40s and 50s, on some kind of government assistance with children. In other words, the type of customer that Citigroup is not exactly eager to lend to. And they make loans for co-op apartments. They also make loans for kind of consumer credit. And they have a 2% delinquency rate. So the loans these people make, these ethical subprime lenders, get paid back at an extremely high rate.
Banks would love to have a 2% rate of default.
You know, Dan, I have to say, this, I think, says something about the way that we've all been ingesting the coverage on this crisis. The phrase ethical subprime mortgage, that's like jumbo shrimp. It sounds like an oxymoron.
Or military intelligence.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. This is, you know, these people who are doing this, they don't, I think if you asked them 5 years ago, they wouldn't say we're subprime lenders. They say we are, you know, we have a double bottom line. They're concerned about the community and they're concerned about making profits. As one of the people explained it to me, they want to be profitable. They just don't want to be, you know, maximally profitable.
Okay, so
in order to have a lending business that is self-sustaining, you have to get paid back. It's right. It can't be a charity. They have to borrow money from people and lend it to other people. And, you know, the difference is how you make your money or how you pay your overhead.
Right.
They've got Shore Bank, which is in Chicago. It's been around for 35 years. This is a bank on the south side of Chicago. It's got about $3 billion in assets. I mean, this is a real financial institution. And, you know, anybody would probably classify it and its customer base as subprime. But, again, its rates of getting paid back, its delinquency rates, its foreclosure rates, much lower than the industry at large.
So what danger are these ethical subprime lenders in of getting lumped in with the bad apples?
Well, again, I think, you know, that old subprime industry of the teaser rates and the, you know, you put no money down and these funky mortgages, that's essentially gone. So it's not, you know, it's not that they're getting tarred with this. It's just part of it is that, like everybody else, they're having difficulty getting credit. So, you know, a credit union basically takes the deposits that people make and lends it out. But some of these institutions have that are trying to get larger and do this on a larger scale have to access, you know, capital markets or get money from other banks. They take deposits from other banks. They sell their mortgages into some state-run and government-run lending programs. So to the extent that this larger mortgage mess is making all that activity difficult, it's creating some headwinds there.
But the subprime mortgage mess certainly was the beginning, the weak link in the chain that triggered all of the other results that we're witnessing today.
I would push back against that. And in fact, if you'll pardon the plug, I'm writing an electronic book on the topic that I hope will be out by the end of the year.
An electronic book? That means I can only get it online?
Yes.
Okay.
And subprime is the symptom. Subprime was not the cause, because the same type of idiotic and stupid lending decisions that we saw in subprime for mortgages at the same time were happening in every other part of the economy. It was corporate loans. It was loans for leveraged buyouts, loans made to hedge funds, investment banks running at 33-to-1 leverage. The same type of mentality that assumed that loans always get paid back, that you can always refinance your way out of trouble, that
right.
You reduce risk by selling the loans to other people. This virus of bad lending infected every component of our economy. It's just that because subprime was to the most marginal borrowers, to the
right.
people who were going to fail first, it just appeared there first. I don't think it's a case of subprime infecting everywhere else. I think it's a case of this larger bug that was out there, and subprime was one of, you know, 10 manifestations that we've seen.
You know what? I got a new name for you. Dan, who doesn't mince words, gross.
Oh.
Senior editor at Newsweek, thanks so much for joining us as always.
I thought I was our long national nightmare correspondent.
Right. That's right. Well, you've got several names, so we have all kinds of choices when you come on our airways.
Happy to do it.
Take care.
Okay.
Do you think people fight for the long national nightmare beat over at Newsweek?
I don't think so, but he always has an interesting perspective. Lots of things to think about there.
Yeah.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm Catherine Land for in for John Hockenberry. As you might recall, 4 years ago, an earthquake in Indonesia triggered a devastating tsunami that killed an estimated 230,000 people. Experts said an early tsunami warning could have saved untold thousands of lives. Yesterday, another earthquake struck close to Indonesia. At this time, the new tsunami early warning system issued a notice immediately. And though the big wave never came, it is clear that the warning systems have evolved a lot since the last tragedy. We're going to be joined now by Dr. Stuart Weinstein. He is Assistant Director of the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center. Thanks for joining us. It seems as though there's been some progress in tsunami warning systems. What exactly changed?
Well, I mean, as of the Sumatra tsunami, there was no tsunami warning system in the Indian Ocean. And what has changed is that there are now several tsunami warning systems in the Indian Ocean, including one that's based in Jakarta in Indonesia. Australia has developed their own tsunami warning system, and so has India. So, yeah, there has been a tremendous amount of progress in terms of tsunami warning capability in the Indian Ocean.
What exactly has changed on the ground for people?
Well, I think the people in that region, as a consequence of the Sumatra tsunami, now have a lot of tsunami awareness. So people who are like living in earthquake-prone areas like Indonesia, and if they're living in coastal areas, and they know that if they feel the ground shaking very strongly, they should start heading inland and uphill as quickly as possible. And so there's been a lot more, you know, tsunami awareness and what's expected of you, you know, when you feel the ground shaking very strongly.
I know that in reading about this, the articles talked about an increased number of sea level stations. What are they? What do they do?
Well, these sea level stations, all they do is they just measure changes in sea level. Originally, countries had them installed in their coastal areas to measure the tides. But today, they're very important in terms of climate research, and of course, they're very useful for tsunami warning systems because it's the sea level stations that provide us direct evidence that tsunami waves were generated.
Now, you were on duty during the 2004 quake, and while I realize there's a question of jurisdiction and your particular center isn't responsible for Indonesia, from your vantage point, because you're watching these things, what's changed the most?
Well, I think, back to my earlier point, is that what's really changed is there's a lot more public awareness in that region. There are now additional tsunami warning systems in the Indian Ocean, and there's much better communication in that region.
What still needs to be done?
Well, that's a good question. I think they've made a lot of strides. I think in terms of Indonesia, for at least from my perspective, there's probably more work to be done in terms of emergency preparedness and trying to get the word out to populations at risk. They were talking about installing a siren system in places like Sumatra and Java where their major risks are for tsunami activity. So there's probably more work to be done in that area.
All right, Stuart Weinstein, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much. Stuart Weinstein, Assistant Director of the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 17th. Mark Garrison has just stepped in with the latest headlines of the morning.
Thank you. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, in California, investigators believe the Santa Barbara fire was man-made. The fire that destroyed more than 200 homes began Thursday near a popular hangout for teens. Fire officials say a discarded cigarette could have sparked it. Arson is also a possibility. Citigroup is cutting 53,000 jobs in an effort to ride out the tough economy. CEO Vikram Pandit is holding a town hall meeting with employees at this hour. On Friday, Pandit invested more than $9 million in the company through the purchase of stock. Officially, the winter's more than a month away, but some in the upper Midwest are getting an early taste. A blast of cold air dumped as much as a foot of snow across the Great Lakes region. The Ohio State Highway Patrol says snowy roads have caused numerous accidents. Iraq's parliament has started debating a new security pact with the U.S. that would allow troops to remain there through 2011. Iraq's cabinet overwhelmingly approved it yesterday. Now the Iraqi parliament has to vote on it next week. Look at the box office. Number one film was Quantum of Solace, the Bond sequel with $70 million. Madagascar's sequel pulled in 36. Role Models, High School Musical, and Changeling rounded out the top five.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Mark. We are this week taking a look at debt, and we're calling this series Debtor Nation, and we want your experience with it.
Hi, this is Matthew calling from Brooklyn, New York. We got into debt, I guess, starting around last year when I got laid off from my job. My wife was 8 months pregnant at the time. After the baby was born, she had a medical emergency, and we had large hospital bills, and I struggled to find work. And as the months passed, we kind of got behind in a lot of our bills. Health insurance was also a big factor in the amount of debt that we've piled up. So that's pretty much how we've got there. Thanks.
We're looking for your stories of how you're finding yourself in debt and how you're getting out of debt. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry today. So good morning to you, Catherine.
Oh, these debt stories.
I know. It's tough.
It's really tough.
It's really tough. And one of the problems, Catherine, is that Americans have one of the worst saving rates in history. And we're in more debt than we ever have been. And we have the highest rates of debt in the world. And as I said, this week we're going to be looking at debt, and we're going to be looking at a number of perspectives. And we're going to start with this. In 2007, American households needed 240 years of savings to pay back what they owe on homes, cars, and credit cards.
Ugh.
We collectively, as a group, we owe about $14 trillion. Ronald Wilcox, author of Whatever Happened to Thrift, Why Americans Don't Save and What to Do About It, he joins us now. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So these numbers are a little staggering. I think I read that last month, 5,000 Americans went bankrupt every day. Ronald, what's happening?
Well, Americans' own household balance sheets are very fragile, so it doesn't take much right now to throw people into bankruptcy. The previous caller that we just listened to had a medical emergency. That's very common. That's a common way people get into bankruptcy problems. But increasingly, we're seeing this just as a result of consumer debt, where someone either loses their job or maybe even doesn't get the raise they were anticipating getting. Even that kind of small fluctuation can throw people into financial difficulty.
And clearly, this is potentially going to get worse, at least for some people, with the market expecting more people to lose jobs, at least over the near months coming. But let's talk about the cultural theme here. Is it just that we don't know how to save, we choose not to save, or we're just optimistic and believing that somehow the money is just going to show up so we can pay our bills?
Well, I think it's all of the above, what you just said. I mean, Americans are... we're at the bottom of the developed world in terms of how much we save. I think one thing to emphasize would be, although we are worse now than we ever have been, typically we have not been very good. Americans are just not good savers. I mean, we were terrible savers in the roaring 20s. We saved more during the time around the Depression. But since about the end of World War II to now, we haven't been particularly good savers, at least relative to the rest of the developed world. Part of that is American optimism. When psychologists look at different cultures and how optimistic versus pessimistic some cultures are, Americans are always right at the top in terms of optimism. And if you think tomorrow is going to be better than today, one of the things you don't do is save a lot of money. People that are more pessimistic tend to save more money. It's also the case that in the American system of retirement savings, that's a very complicated system. We have a very complicated system relative to the rest of the developed world. And a lot of people enter those marketplaces and don't really know what to do. And one principle we know from business and marketing is when you enter a situation where there's lots of choices and you can get very confused, often what people do is they choose not to choose. And I think that's what's happened with a lot of people is they go into complicated retirement plans and don't know what they're doing. So they kind of say, hey, I'll look at that next weekend. And they don't take the steps necessary to begin the process of savings, which is really the hardest part of the whole process.
And given the sensitive economy, the struggling economy today, there is this kind of conundrum, which is you want people to save, but by the same token now, we want people to spend money to stimulate the economy. So how do you weigh those two things?
Well, I'd call it a short run versus long run deal. I mean, in the short run, it certainly is better for the economy if people spend money. In the long run, it's really not good for the economy that people have very poor balance sheets. In other words, that they're in debt. The fact that people are in a lot of debt certainly contributed to the housing crisis that's really dragging and began to drag the economy down right now. The fact that people didn't have any down payments for their homes, and when those homes went down in value a little bit, then, of course, if you don't have any equity in the house, it's easy to walk away. If you had a 20% down payment, it's a lot harder to walk away. So in the long term, it creates economic difficulty when people don't save. But you can expect over the coming weeks and months that the government will exhort us to spend money. You know, when those rebate checks went out to people, they asked us to spend them. And one of the one thing that disappointed a lot of people is that when people got those checks in the mail, what they did was many people saved that money. And so I expect that some of the fiscal stimulus packages that will be floated in the next few months will run into that difficulty as well. It'll be hard to get people to save money or spend money when they're in that deep of debt.
You know, you were talking earlier about how I think there's a sort of generational thing that goes on as well. If you were born during the Depression, you might be more likely to save. But what about this the younger generation that really hasn't had anything like a depression in their lives? All they've known is a governmental directive to spend and prosperity.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things at play there. One is any country that goes through a rough time, whether it be a depression or a war or whatever, the people that saw that in their lives tend to save more, even as they get older. They remember the hard times and that things can get bad, so they save, and that certainly happened in the U.S. Yes, the younger generation saves less, if you look at the 18 to 25-year-olds, less than any American generation. But I think, you know, I'll add to that, they have a special difficulty, and that is that a lot of 22, 23-year-olds get out with a lot of student loan debt, really staggering amounts of student loan debt.
Right, we've heard some of that earlier.
Yeah, and, you know, if you get out of college and you're thinking about buying a car, and you say, hey, it's $15,000, which would be cheap, but and you don't have any student loan debt, you say, hey, do I really want to go into $15,000 worth of debt? And you might not do that. But if you're already in $50,000 worth of debt, you say, hey,
you gotta think
just moving
twice.
The needle from 50 to 65. Actually, what happens psychologically, it's easier for
right.
people to go into debt once they've already had a bunch of debt. So I think what the student loan debt has done is really kind of grease the skids for people to get any, even more consumer debt, where, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that was not the state of the world. And it was easier for people to save coming out of college.
Ronald, in the few seconds we have left, quickly give us some advice on how to consider our debt and how to get out of it.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of financial books out there and a lot of financial advice. I'm going to let somebody else do that. But I'll just point out one thing. All of us, when we think about how much to consume in our lives, whether it's how much, you know, what kind of clothes to wear, cars to buy, whatever, we all look at the people around us. The people we think we're like them, and we say, okay, this is what's appropriate for me to consume. And we got to realize two things. One is our mind plays tricks on us. We often remember the things that we like and don't remember the things we like. When we walk through the parking lot, we remember the Saab, but we don't remember the Subaru Outbacks. You know, and there might be more Subaru Outbacks out there than Saabs. And we think, well, a Saab would be fine for me. Or, you know.
Thank you very much, Ronald Wilcox, business professor at University of Virginia. I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Let's look back to March 4th, 1933.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
For FDR, that meant saving the free world. For his grandchildren, that meant roaming the White House. Today, a briefing book for Sasha and Malia Obama, advice from a grown-up who was once a child hanging out at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 17th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry today. Welcome back, Catherine.
Hey, thanks. Good morning, Adora. Today, we're going to take a look ahead at both the economic signs to watch for this week, as well as some predictions for a lame duck Congress that convenes today. Also talking to a critic of the economic bailout plan. We're going to get some stories about the California wildfires, and we dip into our own briefing book for a talk about our nation's prisons. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
A new report from the National Association for Business Economics says the economy is getting worse and it's going to stay that way for a while. Nearly all of the surveyed economists said a recession has begun, starting either in the fourth quarter last year or earlier this year. They predict slight growth over the next year, just 0.7%, making it the slowest two-year period since the global recession in the early 80s. It comes as news today that Japan has followed Germany and other Eurozone countries into recession. Investors didn't seem to phase. The Nikkei finished up just slightly. Here in the U.S., more job losses at another major financial institution, Citigroup. It has announced it will cut 53,000 jobs.
As we said, the lame duck Congress gets underway today. The Senate is preparing for a collision over whether or not to bail out the big three automakers. The White House and Republican leaders oppose the move, but Senator Carl Levin says it's a core part of our economy.
No other country with an auto industry will allow their industry to drop out and die.
Levin and other Democrats are driving ahead. They say they'll attach an auto bailout to a House-approved bill extending unemployment benefits. A vote could come as early as Wednesday.
President-elect Barack Obama will meet with John McCain in Chicago today, the first time the two have met since the election. McCain officials say they don't expect a job offer, but in his wide-ranging interview in 60 Minutes last night, Obama said he's not ruling out placing a Republican in his cabinet. The president-elect also said that he's focused keeping an eye on enemies.
I think it's important to get a national security team in place because transition periods are potentially times of vulnerability to terrorist attack. We want to make sure that there is as seamless a transition on national security as possible.
Oil's below $56 a barrel. European markets are down around 2%. The Dow futures are also down. And today we are looking for some advice for the Obama sisters moving into the White House. What do you think, Catherine? What would you tell them?
Well, I'm not going to talk about their dog, but we are looking for some advice about how they're going to weather those years under intense scrutiny. Let us know how you think that they should weather those years. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This morning we're looking ahead to reports that are expected on the state of the economy. For a preview of what the markets will be looking to this week, we turn to Peter Morici, who is a University of Maryland business professor. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Let's start with the world markets. Japan is the latest country to report it's officially in recession, shrinking a percentage point in the third quarter. What happened?
Well, essentially, the U.S. economy is slowing down, and the Japanese are very dependent on exporting here. You know, there have been all this talk over the last decade that the American economy doesn't matter anymore. Asia is getting a hard lesson in the old saw. When America catches a cold, the global economy gets a fever.
And does that explain why countries like Japan, Germany, Ireland, and Italy hit recession before we in the U.S. have technically gone into recession?
Well, actually, we are having the same problems. We've been slowing down in our prior quarter. GDP was down at 0.2%. And other than imports from China, which seem to know no limit, and of oil, our imports of automobiles, for example, from Japan have been slowing, from Germany have been slowing. And also, these economies are inherently weaker. because they have lots of that good regulation that folks on the left think will cure America.
Okay, well,
just couldn't help but throw that out there for you.
That's why you are endearing to us. But let's move on to some of the numbers that the market's going to be getting this week. You have industrial production numbers, producer price index, housing starts, consumer price index, and those are just in the next 3 days. What is the market really going to be concentrating on?
I think it's going to be looking at pricing data, because we're waiting to see if inflation will slow down. Now, we're going to get headline numbers that are very attractive on producer prices, which are wholesale prices and consumer prices, because oil fell so much in October. But the real question is, what's happening in the core? You know, higher oil prices pushed up core inflation to above 2%. Now we're expecting it to start to recede. We'll have to see if that indeed does start to happen. That makes it easier for the Fed to keep monetary policy loose, for example. Also, you know, everybody screams about falling prices being a negative indicator. That's part of the economy adjusting. Falling prices does make it easier for people to buy more stuff, even as they rebuild their savings. I don't get as alarmed by that, and I think the market will like it.
Producer price index really is just an average, right, of the price of goods over a period of time. And what's that period of time?
Well, it'll be October. It's an observation essentially mid-month for wholesale prices coming out of factories and things like that, or off import platforms. It's what the department stores pay for the goods.
And the consumer price index on Wednesday, that important?
Absolutely. That's the average of what you pay at the store, whether it's gasoline or a visit to the doctor or so forth. We expect that to be down a lot because oil is going to pull, the gasoline is going to pull down that average a lot. The question is, what is the core when you take out food and energy, which is much less, you know, fluctuates a lot less. And we want to see if that starts to get a little, continues down. The last observation was a very, very good one. It was just a 0.1%. We're hoping to see some more of that kind of information.
Okay, Peter Morici, thank you for that preview for the week.
Take care.
Peter Morici is a University of Maryland business professor and our pal here at The Takeaway. So it's all about prices this week.
Well, I'm hoping I'm another pal of The Takeaway.
Of course you are. You're sitting in for our esteemed colleague, John Hockenberry.
And I'm Catherine Lanford. Now, a lame duck session of Congress is starting today, with Democrats most likely working toward a bailout of U.S. automakers. Of course, that bailout is going to be facing opposition from many Republicans and the Bush White House. President-elect Barack Obama was looking ahead as well yesterday when he spoke on 60 Minutes about the bailout.
Well, let's see how this thing plays itself out. For the auto industry to completely collapse would be a disaster in this kind of environment, not just for individual families, but the repercussions across the economy would be dire. So it's my belief that we need to provide assistance to the auto industry. But I think that it can't be a blank check.
New York Times reporter David Herzenhorn joins us now on the line from Washington to talk about how this and other issues are going to occupy Congress over what could be a dramatic few months. Hey, good morning, David.
Good morning, Catherine.
Okay, now how likely is it that we're going to see the Senate passing some form of an aid package for automakers?
Well, we just don't know. And what you may see is not an aid package, but what the White House and the Republican leader Mitch McConnell are pushing for is really a legislative fix to an energy bill from last year that provided $25 billion in loan guarantees for the auto industry. And so what they're saying is, you know, get that money to them faster and easier first before approving new federal dollars for the auto companies.
All right. Now, there was some talk about some sort of aid that was going to be attached to continued unemployment benefits. Is that what we're talking about here?
It depends, again, on how they do it, and we just don't know. You know, lawmakers are coming back to Washington starting later today and tomorrow. The strategy as they've outlined it is that they will start with a piece of legislation, presumably one that's already been passed by the House, extending unemployment benefits. That's part of what the Democrats would like to have included in a much wider economic stimulus package that they know they can't get done. That there was one version of that unemployment benefits extension that was approved just in September before they left for the fall campaign. So the idea is they would start in the Senate with that, try to add something for the automakers as an amendment to that bill, and then send it back over to the House to get, either get reapproved or figure out how to do the pieces. But we just don't know what form it will take. And, you know, Mitch McConnell has basically held the cards for the last 2 years. The Republican minority is strong enough to block things in the Senate where you typically need 60 votes on any controversial issue, and that large minority holds, you know, until January 6th.
I was just going to say, well, let's talk about the shifting political landscape there. Now, Senate Democrats are going to have to decide on a couple of things. For instance, Senator Joe Lieberman. What is going to happen to his status? He's declared himself independent, but he was counted for a while there as one of the Democratic votes. So is he going to be stripped of his chairmanship given what happened in the last election?
Well, there are leadership votes and all sorts of organizing that's happening this week as well. There are the new members of Congress who've just been elected who are coming to Washington for some orientation activities. The Democrats are in this interesting quandary. There are quite a number of them who really do want to punish in some demonstrable way Senator Lieberman, who was so zealous in his support of John McCain. For a lot of people, he crossed a line at the Republican convention when he wasn't just supporting his friend, but started to criticize Barack Obama. The tricky thing here is that, remember, there are three Senate races that are still undecided in Alaska, Minnesota, and Georgia. And if those all happened, it's unlikely, but if all of those went the Democrats' way, then Lieberman would be the 60th vote in the Senate, which is symbolic in that that's the number you need to break filibusters and push legislation forward. So there's sort of a tug of war, folks who want to punish him and folks who want to keep him organizing with the Democrats. In Connecticut, though, as you point out, he's still registered to vote as a Democrat. There are some people so angry they want him to switch his voter registration.
But, David, it's just so hard to imagine a scenario where he doesn't pay some kind of consequence for what many consider, disloyalty.
You know, politics is a funny thing. There are a lot of scenarios. I mean, the most drastic punishment, the one that he is certainly resisting, is that he's stripped of the chairmanship of the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Other, you know, ideas that have been put out there is that he holds on to that chairmanship, but he loses a seat on the Environment Committee, for instance, that there's some other, you know, you would think that it would be clear cut, but it never quite is. You know, the majority leader, Harry Reid, keeps pointing out that Lieberman has voted with the Democrats 90% of the time and that they've needed those votes. It does look curious from
okay,
the outside.
And very quickly, what sort of leadership struggles are we looking at on the Republican side this week?
Well, some of the on the Republican side, Mr. McConnell seems safe. There are some changes further down in the leadership. John Cornyn of Texas is going to take over the Republican campaign operations. On the House side, there's a last minute challenge to John Boehner of Ohio, who's the Republican leader. Dan Lungren from California has put in a challenge there. Other House leaders have stepped down. Roy Blunt, the whip, and Adam Putnam, the conference chair, have stepped down. So we'll see some new faces. Eric Cantor, for instance, of Virginia, stepping up into the whip's role. So there's a little bit of shuffling going on, and certainly some committee fights as well.
Okay. Here's your chance for the 15-second forecast. What are we going to see this week with this lame duck Congress?
You know, the congressional reporters don't bet on anything until it's signed, sealed, and delivered. My guess is that what you'll see is some type of aid for the automakers.
Okay, thanks so much, David. David Herzenhorn, New York Times reporter on the lame duck Congress we're going to see this week. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Lawmakers are watching Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson closely to see how he's managing the massive $700 billion bailout package. But Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, thinks Americans should be watching the government just as closely. Naomi Klein's Rolling Stone article, The New Trough, parallels the government's use of private contractors to manage the bailout with similar practices used in the early days of the Iraq War. She joins us now from Toronto. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Naomi, what are the parallels between the bailout package and the Coalition Provisional Authority?
Well, there are some key people who have shown up in the same places. But the underlying premise of the CPA was that anything that could be privatized, anything that could be outsourced, would be. And that is something that hasn't received very much attention about the bailout. That the bailout itself, though the public face of it are Treasury officials, the actual work is being contracted out to private companies, to Wall Street banks, to banks like Bank of New York Mellon. In many cases, these are the companies that are really at the heart of the crisis itself. The people who got us into this mess are now being paid to get us out of it. And the other parallels are simply the state of emergency, the rush to hand out the contracts very quickly that created the no-bid contracts in Iraq, the lack of oversight. We're seeing some of that repeat, where the contracts were handed out very quickly with very little competition, handed out to politically connected firms, and now we're seeing once again the lack of oversight. We're even seeing some things that we didn't see in Iraq, like the largest contract that was handed out has been handed out so far is to Bank of New York Mellon, to be the kind of general contractor, the sort of Halliburton of the Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very large contract. We know that. It's the most important contract of all. What we don't know is just how large, because they've redacted the part of the contract with Bank of New York Mellon that tells taxpayers how much they are paying, or even how they will measure the payment for Bank of New York Mellon. Because, I mean, are there bonuses? What sort of incentives are there? This is very important because this Bank of New York Mellon is itself involved in the derivatives industry. They stand to benefit from the bailout directly. They have already benefited because they're one of the nine banks that received the original equity deals. The other thing I talk about in the Rolling Stone piece is that another contract was handed out to a Wall Street law firm to advise Treasury on those equity deals. And that's a Wall Street firm called Simpson Bartlett and Thatcher. And Simpson Thatcher has represented seven of the nine banks, been the lawyer for seven of the nine banks that received those original equity deals. And we know that the deals that were negotiated by Treasury are extremely controversial. I mean, if they were negotiating good deals with Treasury,
right,
then we could all relax. But the problem is it's become very controversial that, for instance, they didn't follow the rule number one of deal making, which is get it in writing. The way those equity deals were sold to the public was that it would address the credit crunch, that it would get the banks to start lending. Now we find out that the banks can pretty much do whatever they want with the $250 billion that has been allocated for this purpose.
And Naomi, that seems to come as a great shock to many. In fact, we spoke with the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, last mm-hmm. week, and he was saying when they hold hearings this week, that's going to be his number one question. These banks have gotten billions and billions of dollars, but they're not relending it, at least not at a rate that he says that they should.
Exactly. And, you know, Barney Frank's even said that this violates the act, which means that those equity deals are illegal under the legislation that he helped author. But I really think the Treasury has lawmakers over a barrel here, because essentially what they're saying is, you know, we dare you to call us on this. We dare you to call off these deals, to try to reverse these deals, because what would be the consequences if it is illegal? Well, then you would have to pull the money out of the banks, right?
But before
and that
we even
would
get to that,
Wall Street panic.
No, I was just going to say, but just to your point, but doesn't this go to the very heart of the discussion, which was this notion of oversight, that was going to be a critical component? And to find out now that the checks have been written, or at least most of the $350 billion, the first installment,
yeah,
has already been written, but the oversight board has not been fully set up.
Well, it's really incredible, and it isn't. You know, you're talking about the fact that they haven't put the key people in place to watch the store. There are other elements of this, like the fact that we don't even know there's $2 trillion. This is above and beyond the mm-hmm. $700 billion. FDIC has also approved these emergency. No, this is the Federal Reserve has handed out $2 trillion in emergency loans to financial institutions, but also potentially to other corporations. We don't know which ones. Bloomberg News is suing in federal court to find out who has gotten this money, who's gotten these taxpayer loans, and what the collateral has been. And this is a really key issue because, of course, at the heart of the crisis are these bad assets, these distressed assets, and no mm-hmm. one knows what the value of those assets are. So if they've accepted those assets as collateral, then that means there's a very good chance the taxpayers won't get their loans repaid. So this is a huge issue, and it's more secrecy. And let's remember that secrecy is what got us into this, a lack of transparency, the shadow banking industry. But coming back to the original Paulson plan, that very controversial three-page document, which essentially said, give me absolute impunity to hand out $700 billion. The original plan was to buy distressed assets, but with no checks and balances. That was rejected. And then we heard all of these guarantees about accountability, about transparency. And so where we're at now is that Henry Paulson has achieved what he originally wanted, but just through stealth, really just through inaction, through what is sometimes described as incompetence. But I really don't think it is incompetence, because this is what they wanted in the first place, which is no oversight. And this is what brings us back to Iraq. You know, we know how this turns out. The Green Zone was referred to as one CPA official as a free fraud zone. This is and let's remember that the reconstruction of Iraq, the original allocation was $18 billion, $18.7 billion in taxpayer money to reconstruct Iraq. There was a huge amount of corruption in that. We're talking about more than $700 billion, and they're repeating the same mistakes.
Well, you know what, Naomi, this means you're going to be in business for a long time, and we certainly would love for you to come back, because we didn't even get to your wonderful comparison between the bailout in Britain versus the bailout in the United States and what taxpayers got there that we're not necessarily getting here. We thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Naomi Klein is the author whose most recent book is The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And now we turn to Mark Garrison, who's going to hit us with a few headlines.
Thank you. Coming up on 29 minutes after the hour, Wall Street's open in about a minute. Dow futures are down about half a percentage point with just moments to go before Wall Street opens. And some fresh economic data just out. Industrial outputs rose 1.3%. That's better than analysts expected, but previously the number plunged by the largest amount in over 60 years. Looking overseas, the Japanese economy has fallen into a recession. The world's second largest economy shrunk at a rate of 0.4% in the third quarter. This is that country's first recession there since 2001. That's your news for now.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 17th. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry. All right, Adora, you know the Obamas are getting plenty of advice as they look forward to a new life in the White House, especially when it comes to their daughters, Malia and Sasha. What school should they go to? What kind of dog should they get? What is it like to grow up under such scrutiny? Well, one person who knows is 78-year-old Curtis Roosevelt, a grandson of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the author of a recent memoir called Too Close to the Sun, Growing Up in the Shadow of My Grandparents, Franklin and Eleanor. The book covers the pitfalls and pleasures of growing up in the White House. Curtis Roosevelt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, good morning. And now, I'm in Atlanta. You're in New York.
That's right. Now, you were 3 when you moved into the White House and 15 when you left. What prompted you to use the imagery of the old myth of Icarus to describe what that was like?
Well, very simply, and it is what the Obama children will face, being too close to the sun really is being too close to all that power that resonates in the White House under any president. But with a president like Franklin D. Roosevelt and with my grandmother, Eleanor Roosevelt, it was a double whammy, a double sun. So, of course, there's the destructive side as well as the extraordinary experience of growing up there. And it's the two together. What it does is distort your thinking, quite frankly. It distorts your image of yourself. And I spent quite a lifetime working out of that. Thank goodness I have. But the point I guess I would make is the fact that no matter how good the Obamas are, Michelle and Barack Obama, at parenting, their children are going to be exposed to a life which I refer to in my book as the gold life in the goldfish bowl, that has a double edge to it. It's both wonderful and it's a distorted picture.
Now, for those who might not remember, you were known as Buzzy, and you and your sister were practically marketed like a Shirley Temple doll back in the day.
You can't use the word marketing because that's it today. We weren't marketed. No, it's just that the press, you might say, hungry for something to divert their readers from the Great Depression, which affected most people in the United States, very few exceptions. And Sisti and Buzzy became well-known across the country just as much as a movie star, the little darling of the America known as Shirley Temple at that time. Now, we were terribly well-known, and as this duet, as I write in the book, all one word, Sisti and Buzzy.
Given that, I know that times are different now, but given that there are these parallels, that we are in tough economic times, that we have two adorable children who are going to be frolicking through the White House, what is some specific advice that you would have for those two little girls about the years they have ahead of them in the White House?
I wouldn't be able to give them any advice. It'd be foolish. Times are very, very different. After all, when I was in the White House, Washington, D.C. was a Jim Crow town. You know, segregation was the order of the day. It was the law. But obviously all that has changed. But the Obama children, and I have no advice to give them per se, except hang on to your personalities. They're just a little bit older than my sister and I were, although by the time I left the White House, about age 15, that's older than either of them. I just hope that they'll not have their heads turned to too much, or if they do, at least try and be aware of it. That's really very much up to their parents. But I do get the impression that just from seeing briefly on television, that these are two quite mature children for their age, quite well-adjusted, which is a tribute to their parents, and I only hope they can stick with it.
Now, I have to tell you, having looked through your book, you're awfully hard on yourself.
I'm just being realistic.
But, you know, using that imagery of Icarus flying too close to the sun, I don't think you were that damaged.
Oh, you don't? How long do you have on the air? And I can explain it to you. No, there's no. Look, it was damaging, and it went on. But let me make one thing clear. I was not the only one who is too close to the sun. All my uncles, James, Elliot, Franklin, John, and my mother, who is the eldest child of FDR and ER, they were all too close to the sun. And I do describe that to some degree, a little bit in the epilogue. All the people around FDR, NER, the immediate staff, the servants in the White House, everybody was just a little bit too close to the sun. Mm-hmm. But for an impressionable, well, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old, you know, as I was, it did skew me. It did distort my image of things. And I spent a lifetime of working out of being pretentious and, to use a very old expression, not knowing my place.
Oh, well, Curtis Roosevelt, you're certainly welcome at this place, and I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And that is Curtis Roosevelt. He was FDR's grandson, and he is the author of Too Close to the Sun, Growing Up in the Shadow of My Grandparents, Franklin and Eleanor. Now we're going to turn to Mark Garrison. He is sitting in for Femi Okeh today, giving us the latest from the news.
Thank you. It's about 21 minutes before the hour. Wall Street is open for business. The Dow and the S&P both down about 1.3%. The Iraqi cabinet has given the go-ahead to a plan that would allow U.S. troops to stay in Iraq through 2011. That deal still needs approval of the Iraqi parliament. A 7.5 earthquake close to Indonesia left at least four dead and dozens more injured. A tsunami warning was issued along coasts within 600 miles of the quake. A Russian court ruled the murder trial of journalist Anna Politkovskaya should be open to the public. A preliminary hearing began today for three men accused of killing her. Her reporting on human rights abuses earned her some enemies in the Russian government. The space shuttle Endeavour has hooked up with the International Space Station. While there, the crew's tasks will include setting up a new bathroom and making several spacewalks to repair a wing rotation joint that broke down more than a year ago. Busy as a bee, it turns out they might not be as active all the time as that old cliche assumes. New research from the UK says bees like to slack off just as much as the rest of us. Dr. Nigel Rain worked on the study.
They seem to be busy only when there's work to be done. One of the tasks that, bees in a hive have to fulfill is that they have to go out and find food, so for nectar and pollen from flowers, and it seems that they'll only do that when there's demand for food to be collected.
So basically, you know, if there's something in the fridge, you don't need to go out and fly around all the time. Just
slacker
kick back.
Bees?
Yeah, they need to do sometimes. I mean, they need to rest because they got to fly all flying around later. Give them a break.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Catherine Lanford, in for John Hockenberry today. You're listening to The Takeaway.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Wildfires in California have spread and ravaged parts of Los Angeles, Orange, and Santa Barbara counties, destroying nearly 800 homes and forcing thousands to evacuate. The Santa Ana winds have ferociously fanned the flames, though forecasters are hopeful that the winds are dying down at least a bit today. Chris Landig was among those fighting to save his home, not once, but twice this weekend. He joins us now from Yorba Linda, California. Hello, Chris, and welcome.
Hi, thank you, Adora.
How are you today?
Tired. It's been a crazy 2 days.
All right, let's start with what happened the first go-around when the flames struck your home.
Well, that happened somewhere around 4:30 on Saturday afternoon. And I had first learned about it in the morning. I had flipped on the Notre Dame-Navy game, and then they were breaking in. We were watching the Selmar fire. And then about 10 o'clock, they started covering the Corona fire. And that's when we started the watch. And we had every TV on the house as we were just doing our normal day. We were just monitoring that fire because that is just east of us,
mm-hmm.
which would extend east to west toward the ocean. So we were monitoring that one pretty closely. And by 12 o'clock, we started getting very concerned where I started pulling my hard drive and loading files into the car. We must have loaded about four or five carfuls of pictures and valuables and things that did not want to lose. And by about 2 o'clock, the police came up and down the street saying, mandatory evacuation. We need to prepare to leave within 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2:30, they were asking everybody to get out. And it was crazy. As we were loading the car, I just kept looking over my left shoulder because I'm just below a ridge, live in a cul-de-sac with a kind of horseshoe mountain that surrounds our house. And you could see this cloud coming towards us. Looked like, you know, a giant thunderhead, and it was just turning and twisting
But you didn't leave. You stayed, and when your home caught fire, what happened?
I actually did leave. I left at 2:30 because I had two kids and a dog, and my car piled up with valuables. So we went to a local hospital where I dropped everybody off. Then I came back. By then, I couldn't drive up, so I hiked up San Antonio, and everything was by then, I got there about 4, and I started hiking up. And by, you know, 4:30, everything was engulfed, homes, and there must have been about 20 to 30 engines, fire engines, lined up San Antonio.
And you just jumped in and started fighting the fire. Is that what happened?
I got up to my house, and everything looked pretty secure. A DC-10 had dropped fire retardant about 4:30. In fact, it was shown nationally. My cell phone was going crazy because people calling me. I just saw your house. You just got hit by the foam. And when I waded through the foam in the backyard, it was about 6 inches deep.
But you were very lucky. You were one of those who managed to save his home. Chris Landing, we're going to have to leave it there, and we thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Chris Landing, he is a California wildfire survivor.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 17th. Mark Garrison is here with the headline, sitting in for Femi Okeh.
Thank you, Adora. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, the White House says it supports aid for struggling automakers, but it doesn't want it to come out of the $700 billion bailout. The lame duck session of Congress gets underway today. Lawmakers will hash out several proposals to help car makers. Word this morning that Citigroup plans to cut another 53,000 jobs in the months ahead. That would come on top of 22,000 jobs already being eliminated. California investigators say the fire that destroyed more than 200 homes in Santa Barbara and Montecito may have been man-made, either arson or by accident. And the FDA is trying something new. It opens 3 offices in China this week. That's the news.
Thanks very much. I'm going to move on to talking about crime and punishment. Catherine Lanfer is sitting in for John Hockenberry today.
Hey,
so glad to have you, Catherine. 2.3 million people in America are in prison and jails. It's the highest incarceration rate in the world. Politicians for decades have been tough on crime, but it's been set against an increasingly overcrowded and understaffed background. What will the approach to crime and punishment be for the Obama administration? Joining us to add a few pages to America's briefing book for the next administration is Martin Horn, the commissioner of the Departments of Probation and Corrections in New York City, and also journalist Ted Conover, author of New Jack, Garden Sing Sing, an account of nearly a year's work undercover as a corrections officer. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Martin, I'm going to start with you. What do you think the number one priority should be in addressing issues of crime and punishment?
Well, I think the number one priority always has to be justice. I think the new president has to recognize that crime control is primarily a state and local responsibility. I think that the new president should be very careful not to feed a frenzy that has led to this country's decades-long incarceration binge. I think that if the president pays attention to issues like jobs, To the social safety net issues, mental health. There's a real problem with prisons and jails becoming providers of mental health services. 30% of the people in prison and jail have mental health problems. We've deinstitutionalized the hospitals and not created the network of services in the community. And I think that to the extent the federal government promotes employment, promotes education, promotes employment opportunity, that will have a far greater impact than to feed some sort of national hysteria about crime.
And there certainly is a causal relationship between unemployment and the rates of crime. But let me ask you, Ted, about your experience inside the prison, and based on that, what would be your first thought of advice?
Well, there are a bunch of ways that we can reduce our reliance on incarceration, which is such a blunt instrument and so overused, I think. It represents a national failure of imagination in how to deal with crime. There are many things you can do to keep people from going to prison, and there are many things you can do to keep people who are let out of prison from coming back in, which is a major source of new prisoners. You know, when I worked at Sing Sing, I was just astonished by the number of young black men who arrived there from Rikers Island on drug charges, and they don't really seem to realize how long they're going to be there. You see over the months, you see them change from sort of rowdy and wild to more somber and sober. I remember I walked with a kid, and he was a kid. I walked with him from the cell block where I worked to the package room one day. He'd gotten something, and he said, I said, so, you know, what are you in for? He said, it don't matter, CO. I'm going to be here till the sun burns out. And to see somebody 22 years old say that leaves a big impression, and you think, okay, what could we do? I'm sure he's done some bad things. He may have done some really bad things, but what can we do to, restore a sense of hope and possibility and mission to our prisons? And I think this budget crisis that's looming all over the country presents mm-hmm. a great opportunity to think, how else could we spend this pile of money that we spend to lock people up? What could we do, and what could President Obama do in a sort of spiritual leadership role to restore an idea of doing something besides putting people in boxes for years and years?
And Martin, Ted brings up a really important point, which is people tend to forget the vast majority of people, men and women, who are imprisoned are going to get out.
That's right.
And there's been this enormous tidal wave of a shift from rehabilitation to punishment. How do we address those issues in a way that make it conducive for when those people do get out, that they have some sense there is a future that's possible that doesn't have anything to do with crime?
There's a growing movement in this country to change the outcomes. I think if we're serious about reducing our reliance on incarceration, we have to change the outcomes. And one of the things that the president can do very specifically is to support some federal legislation, something called the Second Chance Act, that has actually passed both houses of Congress. And I know that spending is going to be tight. But no funds have been appropriated for this program that would provide grants to states and localities to assist men and women who are leaving prison to find jobs, to obtain the services that they need to become productive and law-abiding citizens. And I think one of the things the president certainly can do is to encourage Congress to put forth a substantial appropriation, and then, of course, to sign the appropriation bill that includes that. There's also something called the Mentally Ill Offender Act, which likewise would provide grants to states and localities to keep the mentally ill in the community and out of jail, which is the right thing to do, and also to provide better services for them when they are confined. Nothing is sadder than a mentally ill person inside a prison or a jail. Let me just say that one of the most important things that the president, I think, should pay attention to is where he has primary responsibility is the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which incarcerates over 200,000 people. It's a very well-run organization, but it has grown tremendously. It's almost too big to be manageable. And it has grown as big as it has as a result of the tendency to federalize what have typically been state and local crimes.
Right. Particularly with regards to drugs.
Exactly. And now sex offenses. And it's an area that the federal government would be wise to stay out of, and certainly the president could avoid encumbering the federal budget further if he looked at that, and if he looked at the amount of time that people in federal prison are serving, the federal sentencing guidelines.
And these are enormous issues, and obviously we're sort of skimming the top. But Ted, you referred to some of the racial and class disparities. When you look at who is in prison, black men have a spectacularly higher likelihood of ending up in prison, as do black women, as do Latino men and women, and so on. How do you think we begin that discussion?
Well, I think even more than race, it's connected to poverty. And study after study has shown that most prisoners come from a very small number of neighborhoods. You know, New York State's prisons are filled with people from Brooklyn and the boroughs of New York City.
Only parts of Brooklyn.
Marty's from Brooklyn, I know. I'm sure his neighborhood doesn't produce many at all. But
that's the point. It's just pockets within each borough.
Right. And there's an inmate I met who actually is from Brooklyn who said, Conover, you know, I know they're talking about adding more programs here at Sing Sing. I think that's wrong. I think that it's too late. I think it's too late for people who've come here. That money should go back to the neighborhoods. Instead of planning for the prison you're going to build in 20 years or the program you're going to do here, how about some money? This is a prisoner who didn't finish high school telling me, how about some money for Head Start? How about some money to keep families together, to do things to keep people from me, like me, from ending up here? And this is an even bigger picture, but there's no reason we can't think about it again now. What could we do to make life in those few neighborhoods produce fewer prisoners?
He's talking about New York. I'm going to, Martin, let you have the last word here.
I was going to say that Ted is entirely correct. I think we have to focus on the communities. That's where the true test of our ability to prevent crime and to help people become law-abiding citizens is going to occur. I think the other thing that we ought to pay attention to is where prisons are located. They should be located closer to the communities. There should be fewer of them. And we also should look at the effect on voting. One of the things the president can influence is the Census Bureau's usual residence rule, which counts individuals in prisons as voters for redistricting purposes.
Just adding to our list of issues to take a look at here at The Takeaway. Gentlemen, can't thank you enough. That's Martin Horn, Commissioner of the Departments of Correction and Probation for the City of New York, and also Ted Conover, author of New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing, an account of nearly a year's work undercover as a corrections officer.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. I want to remind you that we are always on here at The Takeaway, and we're asking for your advice for the Obama sisters as they move into the White House.
This is Kate and Nancy's mom from Belleville, New Jersey. I would advise Malia and Sasha Obama to set a good example. Right now in our communities, we see 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old children smoking, drinking alcohol out of water bottles, and even using drugs. Hopefully, these two young girls could turn our country around and our youth could be saved, because it is scary. And to Mrs. Obama, I would advise her to hold on tight to those girls.
Give us a call about anything you've heard on the program, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.